Speaking on this program is Franklin Kemp.
We've been talking about the fact that Satan is interested in us and he's doing what he can to get us. I read this morning from Jude 11 where Jude warns about the danger of going in the way of Cain. We talked about that this morning. And then he talks about also the way of Balaam and of Korah. We won't have time to discuss all of that tonight, but I want to talk about Balaam. Woe unto them, for they've gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward, and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. Balaam is mentioned three times in the New Testament. Peter mentions him in 2 Peter chapter 2. He speaks of him as a prophet, and sometimes I think this has been misleading. Now, those who seem to think that Balaam was a true prophet, I do not believe that that's the case. And in fact, if you look at 2 Peter chapter 2, he begins by saying, "There were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you." And so Peter is talking about the false prophets in the Old Testament. And since he introduced the chapter that way, when he mentioned Balaam as being a prophet, then we should understand the kind of prophet that he's talking about. Notice what he says, "Which have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness, but was rebuked for his iniquity. The dumb ass speaking with a man's voice forbade the madness of the prophet." Well, in view of the fact that he's already introduced various characters in the Old Testament that were false, and he used the very word false prophets in the first verse, I conclude that that's the kind of prophet that Balaam was. And when you look back at the Old Testament, I think that you can see that this is true. Then again, Balaam is mentioned in Revelation chapter 2 and in verse 14. "But I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication." The account of Balaam is found in Numbers chapter 22 through 24. And if you look at the things that are said in Numbers 22 through 24, I think you can see why that he is considered as a false prophet. I realize that there are those who say that Balaam belonged to the patriarchal age, that he had the knowledge of God, and that this accounts for the record that is given in Numbers 22 through 24. And yet, Numbers 22 through 24 three times mentions Balaam as being an enchanter, a diviner. And in Joshua chapter 13, he is called a soothsayer. So when you put all this together, it seems to me that what the Bible is saying is that he was indeed a soothsayer, and thereby he was a false prophet. Balaam is mentioned in, as I mentioned, number 22 to 24. He's mentioned in Deuteronomy 23, verses 4 and 5, Joshua 13, 22, Joshua 24, 9 and 10, Nehemiah 13, 2, Micah 6, 5, and then the passages that I referred to in the New Testament. Well, now, what about him? Was he a prophet? I do not believe that this is necessarily the case, as I've already pointed out. In fact, in 1 Kings 13, 11, we read about an old prophet that lied to the young prophet that God sent down to Jeroboam. That is the word prophet that's used in reference to a man that evidently was not a true prophet. He was a false prophet because he lied. And so there again is a reference to it. But what about God using somebody like Balaam as he did, as recorded in Numbers 22 to 24? Well, think about this. In Genesis chapter 20 and verse 3, God appeared to Abimelech in a dream. Abimelech was not a believer in God. Not only that, God appeared to Laban in Genesis 31:14. In Genesis 41, God evidently was the cause of Pharaoh dreaming as he did, and in order that Joseph might interpret that dream. In Daniel 2, we have Nebuchadnezzar's dream that Daniel interpreted. All of these are accounts in the Old Testament where it seems to me that God appeared to these people in a dream in order that light might be given to these particular nations at the same, around them. Then again, in Acts 8, Simon gave out that he was the great one of God. In Acts 19:13, you recall, there were those who tried to perform miracles in the name of the Jesus that Paul preaches. And so again, you have an example of where there were false teachers that sought to accomplish things along this line. But look again now, in Ezekiel chapter 13, and I think this adds strength to what I've already said. Listen to verses 2 and 3 of Ezekiel 13. Son of man, prophesy against the prophets of Israel that prophesy and say thou unto them that prophesy out of their own heart. What are they doing? Prophesying out of their own heart. Hear ye the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord God, woe unto the foolish prophets that follow their own spirit and have seen nothing. And so, in my judgment, Balaam was a sorcerer or a soothsayer. Balak sent to Balaam and to bring him to curse the children of Israel. And God then overruled Balak, or rather Balaam, and made Balaam say what he wanted him to say instead of allowing Balaam to curse the children of Israel. In the first place, enchantments and diviners were forbidden in Israel. Leviticus 19:26 says, neither shall you use enchantments nor observe time. And so there was a specific for prohibition of their using enchantments. In Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 9 through 14, God lists the things that diviners and sorcerers and necromancers and so on, all of these things that belong to witchcraft, and condemns them, warns the nation of Israel against them. And immediately following that, beginning in verse 15, God sets forth a true prophet and points out how to distinguish between a true prophet and a false prophet. And so, as you look then at Balaam, I think we can see that what really happened, God simply used Balaam as a means of trying to bring light, number one, to a man that was involved in soothsaying. Look at what took place. If you're acquainted with Numbers 22 to 24, you recall how that Balak sent down to Balaam and asked him to come and curse the children of Israel. Look at the number of things that are related in this chapter that indicate the fact that Balak as well as Balaam were both involved in pagan ideas about God. Verse 7 says, and the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with rewards of divination in their hand. What are they doing? Well, this shows the idea that Balak had. He thought that Balaam was one that was a soothsayer and involved in divining, that he was a diviner, and he's carrying with him or sent to him the rewards of divination. And then he mentioned the fact that people have come out of Israel, and he wants Balaam to come and to curse him. Then look at what took place. God appeared to Balaam and told him not to go. Well, now, why I think that proves that Balaam is a true prophet any more than when he appeared to Abimelech, when he appeared to Pharaoh, or when he appeared to Laban, or when he appeared to Nebuchadnezzar. The fact that he appeared to Balaam and told him not to go does not prove that. He appeared to Abimelech and said, don't you take Sarah as your wife. And we wouldn't conclude from that Abimelech was a true prophet of God because he appeared to him. And I do not think then that we could conclude that Balaam was a true prophet of God because of what happened in this instance. But then you notice when he began to try to curse the children of Israel, or rather on his way, God used the mouth of an ass to speak to him. Now, can you not see that this was intended as a further warning to Balaam? I'm sure that Balaam would understand that out of all the soothsaying that he had been involved in, nothing like this had ever occurred. In fact, that's the very point that Peter made, that he was a mad prophet. not recognizing the fact that here is something that is unusual. And so the indication is that that was a sign to Balaam to warn him of what he's doing and try to remind him of what he was becoming involved in. But then again, when Balaam goes down and he begins to set up the altars, he sets up seven altars. The word seven sometimes is used in the Bible in the sense of perfection. But nowhere did God command his people to use seven altars. In fact, God commanded the nation of Israel to have one altar, not seven. Seven altars would be a recognition of a multiplicity of gods. I think that's one of the reasons that God demanded that the nation of Israel have only one altar. And there are several passages that indicate this very fact, that they were to bring their sacrifices to the altar before the door of the tabernacle, whenever the tabernacle was established. For example, in the 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 22, God, we read, "But ye say unto me, We trust in the Lord our God. Is that not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away, and has said to Judah and to Jerusalem, Ye shall worship before this altar?" And therefore, God was attempting to teach the pagan world that there was only one true and living God. And among other things in doing that, there was only one altar by which the nation of Israel worshiped God. And so when Balak then and Balaam set up seven altars in order to try to appeal to God to curse the nation of Israel, that's a further indication of their thinking in the terms of pagan ideas and of sorcery. Then again, I think it's also important to keep in mind that during this period of time, while God was trying to teach the nations round about them that there was only one true and living God, he used various means. You recall in one instance, when the Syrians was opposing the nation of Israel, they lost the battle. And in 1 Kings chapter 20, verses 23 to 28, The people went to the king and they said, "We understand why we've lost the battle. The God of Israel is the God of the hills and not the valleys. Now let's get them down in the valley and we'll win the battle." Now what they mean by that? They had the idea that God was associated with certain geographical locations. And they said, as long as we're fighting with them on their ground where their God rules, we can't win. Now what happened? They got them down in the valley and they lost the battle in the valley. Now what was the purpose in that? Among other things, that was God's way of teaching them, I'm not only the God of the hills, but I'm the God of the valley. That is, he's a universal God. And this should be kept in mind as you're studying the account of Balaam and the things that occurred in relationship to his misleading the children of Israel. Again, in 1 Samuel 17:43, when Goliath was facing David, he cursed David by his God. He thought it was his God that would enable him to overcome David. All of this, I think, simply shows the situation that Balaam was in the Old Testament. Now then, let's think about the fact that sometimes there were those that thought of God as one among many gods. For example, in the 2 Kings 17, we have the account of where the nation of Israel, that is, the northern kingdom, was overrun. And then on down in chapter 20, when they repopulated that with various people who did not know the true and the living God, they began to have problems. And as a result, they went to the king and said, something's got to be done. So he sent some priests over there to help them worship God. And they feared the Lord and worshiped other gods. Now, what were they doing? They simply thought of God as a pagan god among many gods. And therefore, they attempted to worship God in that way and in that manner. Now, I think this is what occurred in relationship to Balaam. Balaam evidently had learned of what had happened with the nation of Israel when they were delivered from Egyptian bondage. In Joshua chapter 2, we read of Rahab. She said, "We have heard what the Lord did whenever he dried up the Red Sea. And it was through this means that Rahab was led to believe in God. Faith comes by hearing, and when she heard what God had done, she believed in God. And you read Joshua chapter 2, verses 10 through 12, and you'll see that that's what took place. And therefore, it's my judgment in the same way. Balaam had come to the knowledge of God, but he only thought of him as another pagan god. And when Balak sent for him, it's on this basis that he came with the intention of trying to curse the children of Israel. God had said to Abraham in Genesis 12, I'll bless them that bless thee and curse them that curse thee, and in thee shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. And so this was God's way then of reminding Balaam and Balak and the Midianites, the people of Midian and Moab, that God was a true and living God, that he had placed a promise in Abraham, and that these people were indeed blessed as long as they served him. Now then, with that in mind, let's look at Balaam and see some things in connection with him as he was used of Satan to mislead the children of Israel and to lead them into sin and to hinder their journey on their way toward the land of Canaan. First of all, Satan still uses enchantments today. Witchcraft and astrology is not a thing in the world, but the instrument that Satan uses to deceive people. There are people today that won't make a move in the morning until they get up and read the horoscope and to see what's going to happen. Well, the Bible does not teach that the sun and the moon and the stars control us. God is sovereign of the universe. God controls. And we do not need to be misled by trying to build our life upon the basis of astrology. Let us not believe that the stars control the affairs. God is the maker of the stars and the moon and the sun. And yet there are multiplied numbers of people today that are influenced by them. But then again, he also uses false teachers. Balaam was a false teacher. Now, whenever he tried to curse the nation of Israel, God made him say the opposite of what he wanted to say. But before it was over, he was allowed to deceive the nation of Israel. He taught them to sin. And that's exactly what Revelation 2:14 says. That he taught them how to put a stumbling block in the way of Israel. And so Satan then uses false teachers as a means of deceiving and misleading us and keeping us from following the truth and believing and obeying God. But then we're told that he loved the wages of unrighteousness. The power and the appeal of unrighteousness is tremendous. Balaam was not convinced of the true values of life. He was concerned about honor and ambition, worldly power, and riches. This had a tremendous influence upon him and caused him to continue to resist God and to try again and again to curse the nation of Israel. Think of the power and the appeal of worldly honor today. How much is sacrificed in the name of worldly glory, the honor that this world gives. How much is sacrificed in the name of ambition? How many lives have been ruined because they're interested in getting to the top and they're willing to pay any price to get there? Principle is laid aside. They're not concerned about that. Out of that comes heartache. They are interested in the wages of unrighteousness. Then you'll notice in the Numbers 22:17, that Satan upped his offer. That is, through Balak. After Balak had sent to Balaam and invited him to come and offered him all the honors and the rewards of divination that they carried the first time, Balaam turned it down. God told him, don't go. He said, I can't do it. Not because he didn't want to go, but because God had told him not to go. Well, when they came back to Balak and said, he's not coming, they've told us, he's told us he can't do it. And the very fact that he had let them spend the night with him was a warning. That indicated that he had a weakness. That told Balak that he had liked to come, and there's just a little something in the way. And therefore, the possibility of getting him to change his mind. And so they sent him back. And when they sent him back, when they went back, they came back with a better offer. Listen to what he says in verse 16 and 17. They came to Balaam and said to him, "Thus saith Balak the son of Zippor, let nothing, I pray thee, hinder thee from coming unto me." Don't let anything stand in the way. Now listen, "For I will promote thee unto very great honor, and I will do whatsoever thou sayest unto me. Come therefore, I pray thee, and curse me this people." Satan doesn't give up easy. When he tries and we resist, then he's willing to up the offer and say, "Well, I'll make you a better offer than that." And that happens over and over again. Too many times we are willing to listen to the second offer. Now, how are we going to avoid that second offer? In the first place, we must learn from Balaam that the wrong desire to start with opens the door. That's where Balaam made the mistake to start with. Whenever the men came to him and said, "We want you to come and curse the nation of Israel," he should have resisted that. Then when they came back the second time, he said, "Well, now, just wait a minute. I'd like to go. I've been forbidden to go, but I'm going to work a little bit more on the thing. Just stay overnight. I'll go back and check with God again. Maybe he's changed his mind." And so he went back to see what more he had to say. One of the gravest dangers that I face and that you face is making up my mind what I want to believe before I ever check the Bible. When I do that, then I'll go back to the Bible to see what more it has to say. And it'll always have that more to say. You notice when Balaam went back, God said, "Go ahead." Why? Simply because God allowed them to do what they wanted to do. Listen, in Psalms 81, the psalmist said that God gave them the desires of their own heart. They wouldn't listen to him. He said they wouldn't hearken to me. And therefore, he turned them over to their own lust. And that's what happens. Whenever I allow myself to desire something that is not in harmony with the will of God, I'll find some way, somehow, to find something in the Bible that will satisfy my mind that's what the Bible allows me to do. I can find the liberty and the basis for doing what I want to do. Satan knows that. And therefore, he seeks through the lust of the flesh, the appeal of the world, the pride of life, the lust of the eye, for us to see things and create within us a desire for these things. And as we think about them, instead of just putting them out of our mind and say, "No, no, that's wrong. I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to dwell on that. That's wrong. And I'm just going to put my foot down and say no." Instead of doing that, we play around with it. We begin to think about it, and it begins to grow in our minds and begins to grow. Read Genesis 3 again. Satan came to Eve and said, "Yea, hath God said." And then he just began to work and work and work. And the first thing you knew, you get down to verse 6, and you find the word desire. And it's rid of the word coveted. And Eve said, "I really would like to do this." And Satan knew right then that he had a trap. And that's where I have my danger. What about my values? The only safety that I have in this world of staying out of the clutches of Satan is to create within my heart values of righteousness that are greater than anything else. And because these values mean so much to me, I would not sacrifice them for all this world. And when I have those values, and Satan comes and tempts me, I can say no emphatically. And he understands that. And that's the only way I'm going to be able to deal with it. How many times have I, and how many times have you, had Satan to slip up on us? Because we let our values slip. We allow the values of the world to become our values. And when we allow the values of the world to become our values, Satan can use all kinds of means of trying to get to us. And too many times, he is successful in doing that. We should learn from Balaam the danger of allowing him to use the things of the world to appeal to us. The only way that we're going to be able to handle that is to begin in the first place to develop within us an appreciation of things that are spiritual. When I come to realize that the real values of life are found in the spiritual realm, that faith, hope, and love are worth more than all this world has to offer, I'm laying the foundation to keep from being deceived as Israel was. Balaam said to Balak, I know how to catch her. I know where their weakness is. Over here, some people, they're involved in pagan activities. They're involved in pagan sacrifices. They are involved in lustly, fleshly affairs. And if we set that before them, if you set that before them, they'll fall for it. And that's exactly what happened. The nation of Israel got involved with the Midianites, the people of Midian, the Moabites. Their pagan, abominable sacrifices and religious rites. And because of that, they were cursed. And that's a tragedy, the whole thing. Can I not see that when the New Testament warns about Cain and Balaam and Korah, that you have three of the fundamental methods and means by which Satan works to try to trap us? Korah was guilty of gainsaying. We don't have time to talk about that. That is, rejected what God said. The world in which we live is filled with evil on every side. Satan is busy continually. He's after every one of us, as I said when I began this series of lessons. He knows our weakest points. He knows where we're vulnerable. And that's where he's going to work on us. I trust that these studies will help us be aware of Satan's interest in us and his determination to entrap us if he can find a weakness anywhere. And if we have one, you may be sure he'll find it. He won't leave it alone. And that's the reason that I need to do all that I can to build spiritual strength. That's my only safeguard. And that's my only hope. That's the reason that I ought to be a daily student of the Bible. I ought never let a day go by without opening this book and filling my mind and heart with it. So I'll know what's right. I'll come to know the values that are highest and noblest. I'll build into my life faith and trust in God. I'll learn to love the right things. I'll stay humble before God. I'll recognize my need of Him. I'll stay on my knees. And through these means, I'll build the spiritual strength that enable me to withstand the onslaught of Satan. If you never obeyed the gospel, as I said earlier, he has you in his clutches. What about your values? What about your desire? Do you want to get out from under it? You can. Through faith and penitence and the confession of your faith by being baptized into Christ. And then to live daily. Aware of the fact that he's going about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And then build your spiritual life day by day so that there'll be the spiritual strength to keep Satan from entrapping and catching you.